This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we take a look at the newly unveiled Climate Change Preparedness Plan for the North Olympic Peninsula, the product of 16 months of work by scientists and multiple agencies. So now, let's go inside the Compass. After 16 months of study, the intergovernmental agency known by the somewhat unwieldy moniker of the North Olympic Peninsula Resource Conservation and Development Council, or more simply as RC&D, has released a 200-page report titled Climate Change Preparedness Plan for the North Olympic Peninsula, which is intended to provide insights and strategies for regional planning agencies in anticipating the effects of intensifying climate disruption in coming decades. A small group of public officials and other interested parties gathered at the Jefferson County Library one recent evening for a presentation on the report given by RC&D Manager Kate Dean and Local 2020 and Jefferson County Climate Action Committee Chair Cindy Jane, who also served as the project manager for the plan's development. Dean was the first to take the podium, and she introduced the work of the RC&D and the rationale for the Climate Change Preparedness Plan like this.
We do economic development work in the two counties, but we also do a lot of grant-funded projects, primarily in natural resources sectors. And we're really interested in where natural resources and economic development overlap, partly because we live in a resource-rich region, and that is what our economy has traditionally been based on, but also because we share a commitment to doing economic development that doesn't deplete resources, but that actually creates meaningful livelihood, maintains resources, and also moves the needle a little bit on economic development. So this project was a great fit in that way, because there's going to potentially be great impacts to our natural resources and to our economy through climate change, and we see planning for preparing for climate change as a great way to do what now in the government world is being called contingency planning. There are a lot of superlatives used when climate change is talked about, and so I want to kind of tell you where we're coming from. Some people have a very fatalistic approach to climate change. It's going to be the end of the world, and that's not where we're coming from at all. Obama said it's the greatest economic opportunity this century. Maybe, we don't know. Some people would say global warming is a liberal conspiracy. There's all sorts of strong ideas out there. So I'm just going to be explicit in telling you kind of where we are coming from, where this the assumptions that we operated from in this project. We see climate change happening. We're not going to argue about that tonight. If that's happening, we're not going to argue about why it's happening, and we're not going to argue about the science that we used. We used peer-reviewed research, best available science, all from very legitimate sources. So I'm not saying those are conversations that don't need to be had, but it's outside of the scope of tonight's presentation and outside of the scope of this project. This project focused much more on adaptation than mitigation. We use the word adaptation. You could also say preparedness, but you'll hear us say adaptation regularly. So adaptation being how we prepare for, how we adapt to climate change. Mitigation being how we prevent climate change, how we reduce our emissions, that kind of thing. So our focus has primarily been adaptation, and from a land use perspective, because that was the funding source. We're going to talk about some other strategies that we came up with, but you'll notice a lot of them are land use focused. The process that we engaged to do this was a little bit unique. Like I said, the geographical area is extremely large and diverse, and we wanted to have a really broad set of stakeholders that we were gathering input from. And you'll see we ended up working with over 195 people throughout the course of this project. The workshops that we held were day-long workshops, and it was really impressive to see people dedicating an entire day to really hammering out some pretty sticky situations. And there wasn't always agreement, especially talking about priorities. What are priority areas? What are priority issues? And sometimes those are at odds with one another. But more likely than not, they were not. They were, you know, it's interesting. We presented this information at a national conference. And afterwards, people came up to me and they said, how did you keep all these people at the table? How did you keep forestry and environmentalists and tribes? And how did you keep them all at the table? And it was great to be able to say, well, I think we have kind of a culture of collaboration. We all see that we rely on these resources for so many things in this region. It's not like, you know, we can all go off and get jobs at Microsoft or something. You know, I mean, this is really the basis of our economy, our quality of life, the way we recreate, our transportation. You know, we share a number of vulnerabilities here. And it was great that so many people stayed at the table. I will say one of the more powerful experiences I had during the course of this project was spending that day out at the Macaw, and one of the elders, a fisherman, said, we rely on knowing for our livelihood. We know when the fish come. We know what to look for. We know all the signs. Our ancestors have known this. This is what we've known. Our existence depends on knowing, and now everything we know is changing. And it was very powerful. Climate change really needs to be at the forefront right now of our conversations. Like the unambiguous story, the planet is warming. Over the last half century, the warming has been driven primarily by human activity. So based on those assumptions, you know, we take the long-term view that, you know, climate, generally, we assume that climate is stable, and that assumption is no longer valid. It is shifting.
Here, Dean went on to describe the mechanics of the so-called greenhouse effect, in which the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases trap increasing amounts of heat in the atmosphere. She then moved on to some of the local climate projections and their expected impacts contained in the report.
Projections for this region are not as dramatic as they are for some other parts of the country, really most other parts of the country. But we can expect to see increase in temperatures. In fact, this, you know, this past summer was kind of a trial run. We saw much higher than usual temperatures, between 2 and 4 degrees centigrade higher than average. So that's already higher than the future projections listed here. They're saying, last Cliff Mass said about 2070, that the temperatures that we had this summer are consistent with projections of about 2070. So we're not expecting to see a huge change in the amount of precipitation we get. It's a matter of when that precipitation is going to come, in what form it comes, and in what intensity. So generally, we can expect drier summers, more extreme weather events, and the things that brings with it, like flooding. We can expect to see more rain and less snowpack. Again, this summer was a great example of that, and that clearly affects number of drinking water supplies, number of ecosystem services. Like I said, we'll get into that a little further down the road. Included in this report, and we don't have a ton of data on this, but human health and livelihoods. So as climate changes, that will affect weather, and that is going to affect have a number of effects, some of that being very direct. So things like heat stroke, things like accidents related to extreme weather events. Those are really direct impacts on human health. But there are many more effects that are one or two steps removed. So increased risk of forest fire, affecting air quality, and having a profound effect on respiratory disease, increased incidence and worsening of respiratory disease. Pollen production is expected to shift. Amounts of pollen when it's released, again, effects on respiratory and allergenic responses. Microbial contamination and transmission, things like infectious disease rates could be changing, where disease is popping up. Crop yield being highly variable, dependent on things like precipitation and temperature, so food insecurity becoming an issue. So these are ways that we see climate impacting human health and livelihood. I think there's a sense that businesses might be less excited to make capital investments, that they're not sure, you know, when we talk about things like sea level rise, you know, businesses have to make decisions differently now. And maybe with a little more risk aversion. And we see that with the insurance industry also changing. And their projections are already shifting the way that businesses can get insurance because the risk assessment is just very different looking forward. So those all affect small businesses, which many of us rely on here. It's also the potential for in-migration to this region being less affected than other parts of the country. We're expecting to see large numbers of people wanting to live here, and how will that affect our communities? Do we need to be planning for an influx like that? Is that going to affect affordability of housing here? And are we able to respond to the demand for services? So these are some of the questions we ask.
For a discussion of the effects on local communities of sea level rise and ocean acidification, Dean turned the podium over to Dr. Ian Miller of Peninsula College and Washington Sea Grant.
You know, we did try to examine sort of the coastal influences in the communities that we live in, because we do live in coastal communities. So, and we did put a lot of effort into sea level rise because there was a lot of interest in this, obviously, in the communities that were part of this project. Every single one of them sits on the water, and so they're trying to get a handle on potential impacts. In thinking about sea level rise, especially in our area, oftentimes we think about just the global average sea level rise. But when we think about it on the community scale, we have to actually think about what's called relative sea level rise, which is the combination of how the water level is changing. And then around here in particular, we have to take into account as well how the land is moving, because we live in an area in which there's very complex land movements. And so for this project, our goal was to try to create community scale projection, so a projection that is as accurate and applicable as it can be for each of the communities within our project area. We started essentially by creating an estimate of what we call vertical land movement for each community. How is the land moving? And so that's what's shown here for a transect, kind of cut across the Strait of Juan de Fuca from Nia Bay. In this case, it extends almost to Seattle. And we have Nia Bay and Port Angeles, Port Townsend, and Seattle marked on here. And essentially, the overall message is the further west you go in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the faster you're moving upwards. And then you hit an inflection point somewhere around Squim, Dungeness, Spit, and east of there, things are on the downward side of things, moving downward. There's two sources of this movement. And sort of their relative contributions aren't extraordinarily clear. But one of the sources is the adjustment of the landscape due to deglaciation. 15, 20,000 years ago. Essentially, the land still responding to that massive ice being pulled off of it. But the bigger source of this pattern is probably tectonics. We live on a subduction zone, and so this pattern's consistent with that subduction zone, with Nia Bay being closer to the subduction zone, being forced upward, and then kind of the land rotating because of that subduction process. So this is probably mostly tectonics, which also has an additional implication that this pattern is only true until we get a large subduction zone earthquake, in which case this pattern changes quite rapidly.
That's my question.
Yeah.
If and when they have the earthquake, will we come up in the eastern side?
It's a possibility. There's a lot of support for rapid subsidence on the coast in Nia Bay. Once you move into sort of the inner strait, Puget Sound, the picture on what the land does during a subduction zone earthquake is a lot more is murky. There's definitely some evidence to suggest there could be some uplift, possibly even some subsidence, maybe nothing, so it's not really extraordinarily clear.
In fact, once variability in projections of sea rise due to differences in estimates of the rate at which Greenland and the Antarctic ice caps might melt are coupled with uncertainties about the frequency and intensity of storm surges, the best service the planners decided they could provide was to supply planners with estimates of probabilities to work with.
We have that probabilistic expression, so this, what's the chance of things occurring? In Port Townsend, 50% chance of sea level rise exceeding 0.9 feet by 2050 and 2.4 feet by 2100, and then a 5% chance of 1.2 feet by 2050 and 3.9 feet by 2100. So that starts to give you a sense of, like, how do you want to play your cards effectively? You'll also note that if you look carefully at the numbers, Port Townsend is a little bit has a little bit higher rates of sea level rise than the other communities, and that's because of that vertical land movement kicking in. Port Townsend is subsiding a little bit, so when you do get the sea level rise, it exasperates it a little bit.
In the Port Townsend maps accompanying this discussion, low-lying areas like the Boat Haven, Point Hudson, Kaitai Lagoon, and Water Street are shown as being at steadily increasing rates of inundation, although the reality might not be as bad as the maps suggest.
So this is simply raising this water level over the existing landscape without taking into account things like tide gates or engineering structures that are designed to keep seawater out. And especially for Kaitai Lagoon, that's a factor. For the Boat Haven area, that's a factor. They have engineered structures there that are designed to keep these kind of high water levels at bay. So that's something that you have to sort of add a level of sort of local interpretation on these maps. Now, the other things these maps don't reflect are things like erosion or landscape change that would happen in response to even a small amount of sea level rise. And so that's another factor. Again, this is just raised up over the existing landscape.
When Miller's presentation was complete, Cindy Jane and Kate Dean came back to outline expected impacts of climate change.
We thought about, okay, where do we really want to focus? And we wanted to look at where we have the right resources available for digging deeper, what's our project capacity, what are the data gaps, what's already being done by other organizations. Ocean acidification is a great example. There's a Blue Ribbon Washington State panel on ocean acidification that's going on. You know, that's being well addressed. It didn't make sense for us to dig deeper into that area, but we looked at more some of the local opportunities, like our particular water supply is something very local that we knew the most about. And then also looked at what was relevant to both counties, since we were working both in Jefferson and Clallam County, and look at how we could best inform the decision making, which was sort of our real scope of the project, and then also looking at what are the timing and magnitude of the impacts. So looking at the vulnerabilities where we ended up and going through that criteria, our three focus areas ended up being critical infrastructure, ecosystems, and water supplies. And so we'll go through each one of them, talk about the key vulnerabilities and what we can do about it. So you can see historically on top, we were pink. This area was primarily pink, which is the transition zone. That means we got snow in the wintertime and we got, you know, rain in the summer and other times. You can see if you look at the west coast of the peninsula, there's a rainforest. There pretty much was all falling as rain. That's the way they've been historically. But as you look going forward in 2040, you see that pink transition zone is shrinking, and then by 2080, actually potentially disappearing. Meaning, just as we saw this past winter with the snowpack being really low, that is consistent with the projections going forward for what we're seeing in this area. So that obviously has repercussions for our water supplies. Here's an example for the Big Quilcene River this past July. We know we had quite a reduced snowpack as well as a very dry summer, and that has implications for our soil moisture. So the red line shows this past year's soil moisture being much below average. Actually, the temperature's higher, snow water below average, and total moisture quite below average. This change in precipitation intensity, even though the net precipitation is the same, if we've got these coming down in buckets, a lot of that rain can end up washing out to the sea, which isn't recharging our aquifers. So that there's real question about how that's going to impact our aquifers. We're going to get the same recharge rate that we've had historically. There's also an issue with sea level rise. In some cases, could impact salinization of some of the coastal wells and coastal parts of the aquifer. And then the longer growing season, which is a good thing, also drives increased water use for irrigation. And then, of course, we have risks of forest fires as well, and then need for water to help put those out potentially. So I think with that, I'll turn it back to Kate on ecosystems.
Great. So this is the last of our three focus areas, ecosystems. Spent a lot of time talking about some of the impacts to ecosystems. I'm just going to dive into a few here. Critical temperature thresholds for salmon. You know, we've discussed changes in precipitation, which is going to affect changes in river flows, both quantity and that also affecting the temperature. So we can expect to see into the 2040s there being much less favorable conditions for salmon in a much greater part of the peninsula. So obviously it's of concern for both commercial fishing and also for the ecosystem, being a really key species for us here. Here we are looking at agricultural product value for different crops. This is statewide annual value of these crops. And we highly value agriculture in the North Olympic Peninsula. It's interesting, we had a lot of, came up again and again as a really high priority, even though the economic impact is not huge here. It's increasing, and there's been a lot of effort to increase that. Agriculture is one of a few, one of probably very few sectors that stand to see some advantage from climate change. Increased carbon dioxide is good for plants. Longer growing seasons, longer frost-free seasons, those are all favorable for agriculture here. But again, as we see rising temperatures, that can be beneficial to plants, and it can also create a lot of drought stress, lower precipitation during the growing season, and that having a pretty large economic impact. So some of the primary vulnerabilities we looked at, the nearshore environment and watersheds. Nearshore is important for many reasons, where we see a lot of residences, we see a lot of shellfish operations, and then also the ecosystem services that it provides in terms of protecting us from severe weather events. They become much more vulnerable due to a number of these conditions we've talked about. Altered sediment delivery, we have feeder bluffs, which are subject to erosion. Those are important for creating our sandy beaches, which serve a number of functions, especially in fisheries. Invasive plants and animals become more and more likely as we see a change in the ecosystem in the nearshore environment. Something we haven't talked a lot about is wildfire risk, and that's something we didn't dive too deeply in this project, but we hear again and again that, you know, there's a real concern here. We'll talk more in a minute about the residential interface with forests, living in a heavily forested area, and with the projections we see with drought, and also a pest increase in pest risk for forestry. Both managed forests and wild forests are considerable.
The final portion of the presentation was dedicated to presenting the strategies the RC&D had developed to address this rather daunting list of concerns.
Here's our top 10 strategies. So as you mentioned, we developed these sets of strategies. We actually developed more than about 20 to 30 or so, ranked 20 or 30 in the workshops. I think we had about 60 in each one of them across the different sections. So the scoring, you see the strategy on the left, the score, we talked about those criteria, we added those up to create an overall score, the type of strategy, so we've got awareness, planning, policy, and then the lead group, what group might be the one to implement this. So some are multi-stakeholders, some are state government, your local government, agriculture, water utilities, wide range of potential lead groups. And then co-benefits. We had these three different focus areas, and for many of these things, we found that a particular strategy might help in multiple areas. So like the top one, enhance education on drought and water supply issues for the peninsula. Not only good for water supplies, but helps our ecosystems, because we know, of course, the fish need the higher water flows to be able to come upstream. So many of these things have multiple benefits. So that's kind of the overall layout. I won't go through all of these, but just to give you an idea of the kinds of things we're looking at. Yeah, certainly education on drought and water issues, and some of you may have attended the drought forum that was held in Jefferson County this past summer that somewhat came out of this project. In fact, Kate Dean was the one who organized that because we recognized that as one of our top strategies. Adopting new regulations for requiring water-efficient appliances might be where we want to go longer term. Promoting and incentivizing smart irrigation techniques for agriculture. These are some of the types of strategies that came out for water supplies. And then if you look at the appendix that has the detail on the different strategies, you don't just get that one line of promoting and incentivizing smart irrigation techniques, but they actually, each one has a set of key action steps that gives you more information about that particular strategy and points you to resources. So in this case, points you to some software that's available to help model some of these things. WSU has some great tools related to irrigation needs. and irrigation issues, so it gives you a lot more information about each one. Another piece is doing outreach and education on climate adaptation to build community support, which you're all participating in tonight. And it really is key because, these changes, it's going to take some effort to make these changes to build a more climate-resilient community. And we all need to be part of that. We all need to be knowledgeable about these changes so we can talk to our council members. We can talk to our PUDs and say, hey, tell me what's going on here and encourage them to move down this path. And what some communities have done is incorporated sea level risk district in their comprehensive plan, where they say, okay, here's an area we know is going to be prone to sea level rise impacts. So what sort of zoning, what sort of codes do we want for that particular area? So perhaps we don't make matters worse as we go forward with new development.
In the question and answer period that followed the presentation, PT Air Watchers Director Gretchen Brewer asked about the evening's lack of any mention of Jefferson County's largest consumer of water and emitter of greenhouse gases.
I'm noticing, in terms of the comp planning and water usage and so on, it's already known that the mill uses 10 to 14 times as much water as everyone else in that water system combined. And they also put out around 600,000 tons of CO2 per year, which is more than everyone else combined. And I'm wondering if that impact can be justified in light of the information that you're presenting and your projections.
One thing I'll mention, that one of the strategies that came up was the municipal wastewater plant in Port Townsend. Might that water, that wastewater, be able to be used by the mill? So that would be a way to at least get a reduction in water usage of the mill. So some of those strategies certainly looked at. I mean, I know the city is in the process of looking at that, the agreement with the mill long term. I think that's up for renewal. So I'm sure climate change will be part of that equation.
Yeah, I would just reiterate that, and I cannot speak for the city by any means, but I do work very closely with the city, and so the contract that the city basically leases part of their water right to the mill, and it's a very substantial majority of the water right, so I know that they are taking very seriously the projections, including the projections we created here for water supply impacts as they look to their 2020 renegotiation with the mill. So it's part of the conversation. I can't speak to the emissions, although I know that it plays somewhat into the, what is the document I'm trying to refer to, Climate Action Plan.
Yeah. No, it is certainly, you're right, it's certainly a chunk of the community's overall emission scenario. Mill has actually made significant reductions in that since that inventory was done. Kevin Scott gave a presentation to the Climate Action Committee a few months ago, and it was over a 50% reduction in that previous emissions, so there has been some improvements in that area.
Well, I would suspect that somewhat, because in their projections, they typically don't count CO2 produced by what they call biogenic sources, but CO2 is CO2 once it gets up into the atmosphere, and it doesn't care what the source is.
That has been getting more research, and that is, I know, changing. I don't think it's finalized, but I know the EPA has changed that. So you're right that is a factor, and that's somewhat a moving target as to how to best do that analysis. But I think when the next inventory is updated, we'll have to look at that and decide what's the right point to take there.
Before adjourning, Cindy Jane announced a carbon reduction challenge contest titled Bigfoot, sponsored by Local 2020, and to commence in December, that will award prizes to the teams that manage to lower their carbon footprints by the largest percentage and to the lowest absolute level. Details can be found on the Local 2020 website. She also encouraged participants to read author Naomi Klein's seminal climate change opus, This Changes Everything, which will be next spring's community read. The full 200-page climate change preparedness plan for the North Olympic Peninsula is available at both the city and county libraries, WSU Extension, planning departments, and online via the North Olympic Peninsula Resource Conservation and Development website, NOPRCD.org. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.